Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 6th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Sexual Addiction: What is it and can a Christian get it? Our presenter is Bill Lennon, session number LEBI 2006-2. Let's listen in.
So, I'm a certified sex addiction therapist, and there is such a thing, which is a fairly new, in the field of psychology, it's a fairly new training that grew out of, and I grabbed some books, and I didn't even grab all the right ones, but this guy, Patrick Carnes, coined the term sexual addiction in 1983 and wrote his first edition of that book, Out of the Shadows. And it's now up to the third edition, and the main difference in the third edition is he's included a lot of things on cybersex and the crack cocaine of pornography, which is the whole cybersex issue in that book. So if you should wind up wanting to buy that, with the subtitle being Understanding Sex Addiction, make sure you get the third edition, because that includes the more recent stuff. Carnes didn't publish his book till 1984 because he had a suspicion that people would laugh at him. So he published it in 1984, people laughed at him, and it was really pretty awful, this whole concept of sex addiction. And in the field of psychology, it became kind of real divergent positions, like you can't be addicted to sex, come on. You make some choices, and you have to be addicted to something like a substance. And they really didn't understand process addictions, such as addiction to food, which is a process addiction. You know, you don't get addicted to what goes in your mouth, you're addicted to that thing that I sometimes, when I'm at a stressful day at our office and I'm standing in front of the refrigerator in the evening, think, I'm not hungry, but I want to eat so bad I can crawl through glass to do it. That's a process addiction, those kind of things. But anyway, by 1990, that really shifted in our field, in that Carnes got a great deal of acceptance in psychological field. I was at a meeting in Minneapolis, of all places, and happened to be around, or seemed to be from Minneapolis. And Bill Masters from Masters & Johnson was there, and a number of other people giving Carnes accolades, and there were 300 people in the room, and everybody stood and gave standing ovation and all that kind of thing, because they said, you know, this thing is real, and it's a real problem, and it's a disease entity, and you get it, and it's kind of like being pregnant. You can be 3 days pregnant, and you don't have it a whole bunch, or you can be 8 months pregnant. There's a great difference. But there is a difference between being sexually addicted and not being sexually addicted, and that's pretty crucial. Today I want to talk a little bit about, and I'll move into that, some of the differences between addiction and deviance, because that gets to be an interesting, and I can't really define it. It's going to wind up, you're going to say, well, he said he was going to define that, but he didn't define that very well. It's going to be like pornography, where the Supreme Court finally said, I know what it is when I see it, but I can't define it for you. I mean, and I can tell you, I have no question I know what pornography is, but I can't write it down in such a way to say that's what it is. I know what it is. I know the difference between deviance, and I'll talk some more about that. It won't be as discreet and as finite as anybody would like, but the etiology, the beginnings of it, are all the same, and it just takes off in different versions with addiction or with deviance. One of the things that, and then Mark Laser, and if anybody's interested in that, I've got a bunch of Mark's stuff. He's a nice man. He worked, he's a former pastor who, in his church, he fell, is the word, and got into his own sexual addiction issues, which happened to be multiple affairs, and you can read about Mark's stuff if you should want to. But he did a lot of writings and has trained for years with Carnes, and they have an institute in Atlanta now, and he and some other people, and they've taken all of the addiction work and really put it all into a Christian context. It's the same basic stuff that Carnes does. Operate on the principle that truth is truth, and so back at the scripture, and you can understand. Because some people are lots more comfortable looking at it from that perspective. A lot of other people have done it. Stephen Arterburn has a book, Every Man in Battle. The first half of the book takes the basic Kearns concepts of how visual, particularly males are, and then you get some different things with females, but the difficulties of fighting the battles of the mind, and Arterburn takes it from a scriptural standpoint, which he goes back to Laser, which he goes back to Kearns. There's some things about that. Let me mention something. It's a disclaimer that I just think is really important to get out. If you should read Kearns' book, Understanding Sexual Addiction, or Out of the Shadows, which I think is something everybody that has any interest in this field ought to read, it's kind of going back to the beginnings of it. And the psychology field is going back to reading Freud. A lot of us don't live where Freud lives today, but you got to go out and read the stuff that Freud said, because that's what started all this business. Kearns has a point in there where he talks about sexual addiction, and he talks about level one, level two, level three. In yesterday's presentation, I talked some about court-ordered offenders being level one, level two, level three. This is not the same thing. Those of you that don't hear, weren't here, don't worry about it. Those of you that were, don't mix these two up. In fact, in our treatment program, we don't even call them levels 1, 2, and 3 anymore. We call them levels A, B, and C. And we do that so people won't mix them up. But sexual addiction, which I'll break out into a little bit more as to how you get it as a disease entity. At level 1, in Kearns' delineation, it deals with issues that are, and he calls them non-crime-related. Now, prostitution is crime-related, but in the sense that Kearns lists it there, he calls it non-crime-related. And it's compulsive masturbation, multiple affairs, prostitution, and sexual activity of that nature, always with the caveat being, it's always when it gets out of control. It's not when somebody is experimenting. It's not when somebody tries it for a while. I've worked with people, for instance, who've come out of divorces, and one of their self-esteem issues is, I'm not an attractive person. And they'll go into a phase of hypersexuality. That's not sexual addiction. So for a year, they're being hypersexual, and pretty soon they say, this is out of my value system. This is insane. I don't like what I'm doing. And they return back to whatever their value system. That's not sexual addiction. That's a hyper period of getting into some activity, but that's not addiction. Okay, so level two in Kearns' nomenclature get into primarily what are called misdemeanor crimes, voyeurism, peeping in windows, exposing, things like that. And level three are incest and rape and issues like that. When you read that, over and over people get frightened or get defensive and say, well, because that's the way we read. You know, we read like a typewriter. You read to the end of the sentence, then you go back, and then you get the next one, and you go back, and you get the next one. It doesn't work that way. It might work that way. But addiction is a progressive problem. As a disease entity, it goes from taking less of whatever it is that's getting you into your fix or your lust or your high or your drink, and it increases. But it increases horizontally. It doesn't necessarily increase vertically. People can be addicted to cybersex, to pornography, and increase dramatically in that and get take more and more and more of that to get the same hit, but never go down to exposing. Or they may, but there's no automatic. It's that silly kind of thing that we know that essentially everybody that does heroin at one time drank milk. But everybody that drinks milk doesn't go on to using heroin. I mean, you can't make that jump. Now, having said that, I would say essentially all, because of boundary breakdowns and other things, not because of the addiction, I'd say essentially anyone who molests children has had issues with pornography. It's almost always the case. But everybody that has issues with pornography does not molest kids. So that's something. It's just something. It's important for me to say.
So it's like pornography. I mean, because I know people talk about like gateway drugs or whatever. Uh-huh. Is pornography? Can you sort of call that like a gateway?
Certainly.
So it's sort of kind of an entry point or something, and then people may.
May or may not. Gateway drug, I mean, I can't tell you the number of people that I know that at one time in their life smoked marijuana, and at another time in their life think, well, that was fine, but I don't do that anymore. I don't have any interest in doing that. Mm-hmm. And I know some other people that are 50 years old and are still smoking marijuana, you know, mm-hmm. and other things too, or maybe not. So, yeah, you could put it in that category. What I find with, to digress to that for a moment, people that are obsessively using pornography, and I'm going to get into this in a minute about the isolation and the intimacy issues.
Hi.
To get into isolation and the intimacy issues, sexual addiction and sexual deviancy, in this sense, wind up being, if you can bear with me here, they're not about sex, they're about intimacy. They're about a discomfort at the level of how I feel, and I can learn to use something or some process so I'll feel differently. What that feeling is all about is always about I don't have a skill set to develop the kind of intimacy that I desperately want. That's what it's really all about. And one of the images I use to try to help get that idea across is if you took a mannequin, and believe me, this is not a sexual example, but some people, oh, what's that guy even talking about? If you took a life-size mannequin, for instance, and you begin to fill it up with water at the bottom, and I got this idea when I was working with people to stop smoking, and this is the chic strategy, and it's effective, I mean, because it's an addiction. And the addiction around smoking is much more, even though nicotine is the third most powerful drug that you'll get, the only one, crack cocaine is more powerful and addicting, but and maybe heroin, maybe not, but still, you can get off of the addiction to nicotine, within a couple of weeks. I mean, it's different, but the real addiction is to the psychological process. I used to smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And breaking my own pattern, and it's been years since I've had a cigarette, but breaking my own pattern that was most difficult was learning the ritual, which is what we have to do with all working with addiction or deviance. Learning that the psychological process of making my feelings change, you know, once I figured out my routine, and everybody has one that does an addiction, it's always in ritual. I had a way I would tap the pack. I had a way I would touch my lips. I would light it. I used to wonder why after the third drag it didn't taste good anymore, because I was so excited to get the first drag, and then it wasn't good anymore. But that's the addictive process, and interestingly enough, and anybody that's been around anybody that quit smoking will know what I'm saying, or you're on the sub, but you think for different reasons. What do you think the primary emotional reaction is when you quit smoking? What would you guess?
Sadness.
It's anger. And one of the reasons that cigarettes work so well is in our society, we don't do anger very well. Mm-hmm. And most of us, I'll raise my hands too, are pretty uncomfortable with our own anger. And I'll go back to my analogy of the feelings starting to fill up. Imagine that they're starting to fill up and they get more and more up into here where maybe I'm going to really feel the feelings and I don't like really feeling those feelings, particularly if it's an anger feeling. And I have a ritual that I can go to that will completely take me away. Boom! The water's gone, the feelings are gone, and I'm into my ritual, my cigarette ritual. I'm tapping it, I'm touching my lip. All of a sudden, I'm caught up in my ritual or in my trance around my ritual, and the feelings are no longer there. Well, you take that with food, you take that with See, a person who's alcoholic, the problem certainly is taking the drink from here to here, but it starts way before that. There's a feeling of dissonance, there's a feeling of dis-ease, there's a feeling, I want to go get my fix, and the whole preoccupation begins to go. Well, the same thing is with the whole sexual issue. It just shoots down a different neural pathway. And what happens is the preoccupation that begins to go that, oh, my wife is going to be gone this weekend, and I've got free access to the internet. And it begins to boil just a little bit. Well, bills, babies, new job, that stuff begins to dissipate as that water flows out because I'm thinking about I've got free access. The preoccupation starts around the sexual issue. Used to be, and that's really what you addict to, because as that preoccupation starts, there is a neurochemical released in the brain which starts in little bits, and over, people will say when someone has acted out sexually in an addictive manner. I'm not talking about choice now. In an addictive manner, people will say, what were you thinking? Well, you're not thinking, you're on drugs. It's an internal release that's the closest thing to human cocaine. It's like we produce the same thing, and it's really not about the picture or the cruising for the prostitute or the sexual contact with the kid. Those are huge. But what it is the release of the endorphin in the brain, which then makes all the feelings change. And that's why in treatment we always say, we're not concerned about how you're doing on your best day, we're concerned about how you're doing on your worst day. So sexual addiction, sexual deviance always moves into when you're in a triggering situation. Summertime comes, every sex act's in a triggering situation because people don't wear as many clothes. Oh my goodness, the vision, woo, what do you do? Go live in a cave? So it's a triggering situation. You're more likely, if you're stressed, Alcoholics Anonymous will teach you hungry, angry, lonely, tired. If you get one of those four, you're probably okay. Two of them, you better look out. You get three of them going, and the chances of taking a drink are higher. Well, with sex addiction, we deal with hungry, angry, lonely, tired, but we also look at the bear, boredom, entitlement, angst, and resentment. Interestingly enough, though, they're all things that are way back from anything sexual. So doing treatment or self-treatment to begin to really realize the issues is it's always in a pattern. It's always with an endorphin release in your brain, which then begins to shift your mood, shift your mind, and it's really understanding, oh, you mean this isn't about an erection. This is about me being angry. This is about me being sad. This is about me feeling lonely. With the ultimate, it always goes down to intimacy, where I don't know how to get my deep levels of intimacy met, either spiritually or interpersonally. I just don't know how to do it. Therefore, buying some kind of a shortcut and taking those moods away. Some people do it with food, some people do it with alcohol, some people do it with cocaine, some people do it with sex. So,
yes, sir. Could you repeat those additional four kind of triggers for sex addicts again? Boredom, angst?
Boredom, B-E-A-R. I made up the bear. Halt, bear. Boredom, entitlement, angst, and resentment. I just, I'm entitled, I have worked my program so hard, I have a right to at least reward my McDonald's. You know, you deserve a break today. You've been doing your program so well, and I work with a whole lot of computer type folks, and don't ask me why, but the two that the computer folks tell me of that little foursome that I made up is boredom and resentment. I just get so bored, and it's so easy. Two clicks away, and I'm completely captivated by the internet and the pictures and the downloading. And it's absolutely mind-boggling. Even the guys that talk to me about it will say, I work for a company where they know and I know they have an absolute scorched earth policy. If you look at anything that's pornographic, you're fired. HR brings your keys that day. And everybody knows that. And the amount of time that's spent on the internet looking at pornography is staggering. I mean, it is just staggering. One study with the millions of hours that are used, I thought this was fascinating. The hours at a number of the biggest companies that are doing, that have now been checking as much as they can, will say, and the internet use is between 9 and 12 and 1 and 4, but it's not during lunch hour.
They go to lunch.
Yeah, we go to lunch.
It's hungry,
yeah. At any rate, please do keep...
Bill?
Yes?
What's the resentment? What would trigger resentment? Resentment against what? Anything?
I'm going to get a little bit more, I'm being pretty generic, into the sex stuff, but my wife isn't sexual enough with me. She just doesn't understand what my needs are. And my needs are, I am more sexual than most other people, and why doesn't she understand that? Why doesn't she take care of me? Now, it's interesting that, and Bree works with many more of the women in our facility than I do, but it's not about how sexual you are. And one of the things that, and correct me if I don't say this succinctly or correctly, for the women, everything the man does, if you're partnered with a sex addict, you remember there are women sex addicts too, so I'm picking on us guys because the numbers are higher, but if you're partnered with a sex addict, every activity that they engage in affects you, but it's not caused by you. But what the women sometimes do is take on the feeling that if I weighed less, or if I wasn't so mean, or if I, and get into some real craziness about that, but the guy can propagate that and even believe that. And I'll talk about that in just a second. When a guy gets into a mindset that says, I neurotically need more sex than most people, or I this, or I that, and it's all a crazy kind of thinking process, but if that's what I think I need, that's what I operate on, and that's really not what it's all about. We worked with a family, this was before Bree worked with us, but I remember down in Tacoma, we worked with a family, and I don't usually drop my jaw too many times, because I've been in this field too long, but this guy and his wife, by both report, would have sex 3-4 times a day, and he still molested a daughter in the family. It obviously didn't have anything to do with how much sex he was getting, because this isn't about sex. It's about an internal emptiness, and it's all about intimacy, and... Okay, so I said that 14 times. I want to speak a little bit about this neuropathways. And I think I'm going to say it. Bree and I were talking about, I didn't say this before, but there's a woman named Helen Fisher, and if anybody cares to go look this up, she's an anthropologist who's done a lot of work in this area, and she talked about the neuropathways as they develop, you know, these little things that go on in the brain, and the best way that I can think of it simply, because I'm a relatively simple person, I don't get too complex. You're smiling at that. A guy named Luria, who was a psychologist in Russia, did, a lot of people have done this work, he just happened to be the guy that got named, and he did a lot of craniotomies, and he would take the top of people's heads off, and he would touch with electrodes and do a lot of things, and you could get smells, and you could get remembrances, and so forth and so on. And what he told us, and a lot of people have replicated this, is that any experience you have is now recorded in your brain, kind of like a computer. This hour that we're going to be spending together, we are spending together, will be recorded in your brain. Now, it may not be as profound as the first kiss you had in your life. It, you know what I mean? This may not totally impact your life. But it's an experience, and it's recorded. If you picture your brain kind of like a flat glass plate, and the neural pathways are etchings. And all an etching is you take acid and you carve little lines and little things and make it pretty. Well, if you metaphorically look at your brain like that, it like you make grooves, and the more an activity is repeated, the deeper the groove is. Now, if we met like this every day for the next 3 years, whether you loved it or hated it, you'd remember it. Because we repeated it over and over and over again. Now, if it was highly stimulating, that would groove it even deeper. Here's one that grooves it even deeper than that. If it was very shaming, That grooves it even more. And then, if we tie it with an ejaculatory response, which is incredibly intense, it digs the groove even deeper. So, we've got these grooves going on in our brain. Well, what Helen Fisher says is that the first neural pathway that was developed in the beginning, and it still happens to us as we're born, is, you know, these running off these little riblets of your brain, is the drive to mate, and that's the libido and lust. That one was there with us way back when with our ancestors, and that was a very natural, that kept the races going, you know, that's a, that whole thing. And the next neural pathway was attraction and romance. Now, we all know that it's better to reverse those, but it doesn't work that way. It would be nice if you had a really good friend for 5 years, and then you jump into lust. But and I'm old enough to know it that there was an old song, and I think it was the Monkees, but somebody will tell me if you remember it. But the song was, "Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name?" Well, wait a minute. That happens that way, but it's probably not the best way to do it in terms of a long-term relationship. But we're wired that way.
Keeps us busy, boy.
It does, and we're wired that way. So, and I'm not saying we're going to be able to change that. So, the second one is heightened, and what happens when we get into this attraction and romance is there's dopamine and norepinephrine are released in our brain, and there's a reduction of serotonin. And what really goes on then, and it lasts about 6 to 18 months, and we are blown away. We are blown away. That person, whoever that person is, we can't catch our breath, we just love to be around them, and it's interesting, we get sick less, we have less colds, our complexions clean up, everything goes well when we've got those kind of drugs running through our system. Affairs are built on this. I mean, it is just mind-boggling. 6 to 18 months later, that begins to shift. And then if you look developmentally, we go into the third neural pathway, which is attachment and bonding. And attachment and bonding is built a whole lot more on friendship, on intimacy, on a whole lot of things other than the other. And if you're lucky, like I am, you periodically jump back into here. And you fall in love again for an hour, for a day, you're gone for a week. And you can get this back, but it's never going to be like it was when you're blown away for that first 6 to 18 months, because the neurochemical patterns shift. And now we get into some stuff like called oxytocin and some anything. Oh, come on, I just wanted it to be loving. I didn't think it was all that chemical kind of stuff. That's not even fair. But I was just reading recently, and my wife and I were talking about this oxytocin stuff, which is much more geared to this neural pathway than this neural pathway, happens in men. There's a 5-time increase in oxytocin when they ejaculate. With women, there's an increase in oxytocin when they get touched, physically touched, rubbed, back rubs, arm rubs. So we got to think about that. You know, what does that mean? Now, I'm not saying, because I'm going to articulate this in a second, that sex, ejaculatory stuff doesn't have to happen. Touching does have to happen. But we need to keep in mind that it's easy to be really excited about for guys, that oxytocin release, because that's really wonderful. That feels really, really good. And we don't get that as much from just having a back rub. But our partner may. So then there's a whole lot of stuff that people have to understand about how to be couples. But
can I ask, yes,
and we're not here for that today.
It's a quick question. So okay. Is the norepinephrine and dopamine surges then the thing that becomes addictive into the brain? I mean, if that's the problem.
Well, it is. And thank you for asking that question. I'm not going to do much with that. But what happens with a sex addict is the continual search for this feeling. And you see, you get this feeling, you don't get this feeling unless you go to a new person or a new activity. And then you get it again. And then you get it again. And then you get it again. So you can addict to that kind of process. And then there's tremendous crashes and burns. And it can run short term, for every 2 weeks. I worked with a man, just a sweet man. His pattern was over 19 years, he had 5 or 6 affairs. But his affairs would be a long build-up thing. Now, he was the son of a very well-known evangelist, and he was a strong fundamental, not fundamentalist, but his Christian faith was really profound in him. So you can see he'd go into a lot of grief and guilt each affair that he would have. And finally, after we got all this worked out, he really understood it, and I think he really got aware of his addiction. And you might say, and I don't think you would say, but well, 5 times, that's not so big in 19 years. His wife didn't think that was, she thought that was pretty big. I mean, and he didn't do pornography, he didn't do anything else. But he'd have it would take him 6 or 8 months to get over the guilt of the last one, and then maybe another 6 or 8 months. And he had a long-term cycle where he would addict to that process, and he just couldn't find that at home. That release, because he hadn't had the bonding and the intimacy stuff. And he had some real stuff about his own abandonment with his father, where he was out saving the world, but he wasn't home being much with him. And he had a lot of issues around that. And anyway, yes, you can addict to that process. And I want to say to you that where one of the things that now we get another neural pathway that creates a real problem, and that's deprivation. If you get into deprivation, then it overcomes these in you, well, it doesn't overcome, but it pushes you more toward addiction, where it brings you into this particular piece that I put there, with any kind of activity, but now I'm speaking mostly about sex. First you have a choice, then you habituate the pattern. And in our society, we're taught to groom, and you know, and we hi, how you doing? Let's go have coffee, and can I kiss you? And all that's pretty natural, wonderful stuff. There's not necessarily, it's kind of like fire, you know, fire is good or fire is bad, depending on how you use it. But there's a point where if your activities have become habituated so much that the neural pathways shift, then when the neural pathways shift, you no longer are able to go from the first to the second to the third, stay away from the fourth, and really developing the nurturing and the bonding. But you now addict to that process of the releases, and that's what you want. And you keep bopping from one to another. And it could be affairs, it could be long-term affairs, it could be guys I've worked with who have looked at pornography for... Like, you know the story, so maybe you don't know the story. 6-8 hours, one professional man that I worked with would, well, we both worked with the family. Sometimes he would watch internet pornography for 6-7 hours all night long, and then couldn't get into work the next morning because he was too tired. So he began to have lots of financial problems because he was so addicted to looking, and you're looking for that next hit. And it's because you operate out of deprivation, it's never enough. Well, it never will be enough, but it feels like the next one, the next picture, or the next affair, or the next cruising, or the next, it's all going to work there. Because there is a release in the brain of the drugs. Boom, I'm going to shift over to here a second. I've got to really hurry up. My goodness. Sex addicts, core beliefs. One, I'm flawed. Number two, I can't really count on anybody else. I have learned to self-soothe, even as a baby. I'll try to go quick here now. I used the example the other day of a pediatric psychiatrist at UCLA who has written a wonderful book. What is it? The Emerging Mind? The Developing Mind. But talks about how... He gives an example of a mom who comes home. She's tired. She's a great mom. She's a single mom. Somebody's taking care of her little baby. And she wants to take her shoes off for 15 minutes. And so she's kind of, the baby's sitting over there crying a little bit. So she's just, you know, shaking. And she just wants to have a cup of tea. And then she'll pick the baby up and feed the baby. And so, you know, it's not a mean thing. Well, that baby now is beginning to say, I'm giving out the normal natural signals that I give when I need to be taken care of, and my caretaker isn't taking care of me, therefore I have to learn to self-soothe. What happens with a sex addict is take that pattern, develop it out over a whole bunch of other times, and then, oops, I discovered pornography, or oops, I discovered something else, and I learned to self-soothe to shift all my moods, so I no longer feel resentment for the next 12 minutes or 2 hours or whatever. I'm just totally enthralled with whatever my activity is. And the activity doesn't have to be that. It can be grooming. I worked with a guy who, he coined the term for me, trolling. He said, every time I talk with a woman, I'm trolling. I'm looking for some kind of hit. And he said, I don't get sex with them that often, but what I do get sometimes is they make me feel good. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm trying. So there's a hit that the guy gets that makes, when this woman makes him feel like, oh, that makes me feel good. But, so I can't count on anybody else. I've got to do it myself. If you knew me, if this is the third core belief of a sex addict, if you knew me, you'd abandon me. And since I can't count on anybody else, and I don't feel really comfortable inside my own skin anyway, I can't tell you that I like to look at pictures, or I can't tell you if it should be it's developed that far that I like to touch children. I can't tell you any of that, because you'll leave me. And guess what? Sometimes when you do tell, you do get left. So, I mean, it's a real scary kind of a thing. Sex addicts, the underlying belief, philosophy, concern is that of abandonment. I can't. So I have to build a secret life, and I got to keep it secret, because ever since I was 13 and I had a Playboy magazine and I hid it under the covers or whatever, you know, when the kids first get on drugs and they start building shame, I mean, get on the drugs that kids go through at 12 and 13 when you start developing, this has got to be secret stuff. If there were a simple answer to breaking sex addiction, it's you're only as sick as your secrets. See, if you can bring it out, if you can be totally open and honest and not be shamed around it, oh, goodness, there's a thing in the Bible that says confess your sins before men and change your behavior. But see, everybody's scared to do that, because if I confess these sins, and I'm your pastor, and I'm up there in front of the church, and I'm telling you that I like to go look at pornography, and I have had sex with half a dozen congregants, I had a pastor that eventually had that situation, and guess what? They threw him away. Now, I don't know that there was any other answer, but they defrocked him, and he isn't a pastor anymore. And then the fourth one is my greatest need is sex, and this is where I'm going to try to tie that really as quickly as I can. If you take this continuum and say that at this end, these are two emotional thermometers, and at this end is want, where you have choice, and at this end is need, where you have compulsion, we can get around sex. The psychobabble term we use is a cognitive distortion that says, I need sex, or I need to look at that picture. That's not really true. We want it, but we have then convinced ourselves that we need it. And if we think we need it, it's no longer an ethical issue. It's an, well, but that's what I need, because I can't make these bad feelings go away, these empty feelings go away, if I don't get that. So that's a craziness. We need a few things. We need air, we need water, we need temperature control. We need physical touch, but we don't need ejaculation. I asked a guy one time, what would happen if you didn't inject? He said, well, I think my testicles would blow up. Well, they don't happen. It doesn't happen. There's a regulator in your system. It builds up for whatever a guy's cycle is, 2, 3 days, 4 days, and you know what? It levels out. It doesn't keep building up until you blow up. It doesn't work that way. At that point in time, the psychological process takes over. Well, it is building up. I'm in pain. I mean, nobody in this room, of course, but some young guys will say to some young girls, you have to do X, Y, or Z because I'm going to really be in pain if you don't. And, well, there's some truth in that, but if you go pick up the bumper of the car, it takes care of that. I mean, just put some physical strain on it. I know. It takes care of it. But it's a great line, and lots of times, guys from, at least they did in my high school, and I've told that story before, and other people seem to understand that. But what happens is this deprivation that I'm going to die if I don't get it, whatever it is, gets tied to this cognitive distortion. And what happens with this as it moves forward into deviance is that the behavior that a person adapts to make those feelings shift are deviant versus, do we want to say acceptable? I mean, we don't get as upset with someone who looks at, collectively we don't, with adult pictures on internet pornography. But we get more upset if they look at child pictures, and we get way more upset if what they do is touch a child sexually. I'm saying from the psychological standpoint, it's all basically the same thing. But it's moved into a direction. Some people will look at pictures of bestiality, or and they will never go to a child, but they'll go to some other deviant or bizarre kinds of things. The basis of it is all going to come back to is that there is this process. Now, one of the things that somebody said yesterday, which I just want to hit quickly because I can't... That clock... Oh, okay. Oh, I was thinking 10:30. All right, so we got a little bit more. Let me say one thing that as I get into... I keep saying, let me say one thing. That's what I'm trying to hurry too much. I'm not interested in excusing people that molest kids. I mean, that's not what I'm about at all. I am interested in explaining the process that happens so that in the cases where we can remediate or help or treat, then we can do that in such a way so that the next child won't get hurt or the next family won't get destroyed if it's sexual addiction. So does that make some sense there? And the underlying principle with the theme of Holden Village this week is if you buy some of this stuff that I'm saying, and there is a background and an understanding of why people do some of this, then what does it create for you if you say, on the one hand, I'm a Christian, but I've got limits on how far I will accept the lepers of my community. Maybe I'll accept black people, but I'm not accepting homeless people. Or maybe I'll accept black people and homeless people because of Holden Village. Those are two pretty acceptable. I might even go so far as accept gay people, but I'm not going to accept child molesters. Well, what I think we have to look at is what does it do for us inside? Because child molesters scare the bejeebers out of most of us. And I don't want to pretend that we don't have to, and that's going to be our main theme of the workshop tomorrow. How do we set boundaries so that if you have an inclination to do that, someone could have an inclination or have maybe touched the child, but could still come worship in your community. It's like the issue that is important for me to look at is how do you reconcile that inside of you? What are your issues? Because I don't have an answer for that. Every one of us has to deal with what we do with that inside. I don't want to work with... I do a lot of assessments for the court. And the way I rationalize what I do, and I'm not denying that it is if I write this big long report for the court and I say this person is treatable and amenable and they're safe to be in the community, but this person is not, the knots go to prison. The way I rationalize it is the knots are far enough out on that continuum that I don't know how to treat them and I don't think anybody knows how to treat them. So what I say is disease is treated, but sociopathic behavior, when it gets, that has to be controlled. Then you get into some other workshops. Well, then maybe you kill those people. That's the simplest thing. Saves a lot of money. But then that creates some problems because do we think that's okay to kill people just because they molested a kid or just because they killed someone else? I don't know. That's another workshop. But I know this much. I don't want people running around in my community that are going to hurt kids. So somewhere my message is some people can be treated. Now, you know, I think at the very, 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 very deepest level that maybe all people can be treated. If you had enough time and enough money and enough treatment programs and enough, but I don't have any of that. So I make a discrimination. So before I answer your question, I'm still going to say the issue is, and I want to hit a few things about what child molesters tell us, because I just want to alert you a little bit, scary about it here, but child molesters are alive and well. I do believe there is good treatment for some child molesters, but then we have to discriminate. And I want to say one thing here about this closed system. It was brought up yesterday, and I forgot about it. Don't be a part of any kind of a system that is closed. Like, I'll run into churches, the Lutheran Church being one, the Mormon Church being another, the Catholic Church being another, that will say, we want to handle the problem ourselves. We don't want the cops involved. We don't want this. We don't want that. And believe me, since I've spent 25 years doing this, I can guarantee you that there are some police people and there are some child protective service workers that are so bad, and they will mess things up so badly. But there are some that are absolutely wonderful also. But we have to go with that system. Because in an incest family, when dad says, let's don't tell mom, this is our little secret, it's keeping the system closed. But the same is true in the church. The same is true in any kind of an organization. You have to speak up and bring some light on the subject. And it is always complex. Bree and I know a therapist that we have a lot of respect for, whose son, and this guy reported his son to Child Protective Service when what he did was, and he had done it more than once, while babysitting, had begun to explore with his little sister. And he was 15, and she was 2 or 3, and he was looking at her and touching her. And, oh, he was, maybe we ought to handle this right in the family. We know what we're doing. And he just said, no, I'm going to call CPS on my own son, and we're going to get into the system and get working on it. And, whew, it was painful, difficult, but... See, you've got to keep the system open, get the system open. When the system stays closed, you run into so many problems. And now, yes, sir, you got a question.
Well, I was just curious. When you assess kind of people that you think possibly could be treated versus not, I would imagine being able to understand this process is probably a huge part of being able to understand the disease process and being treated. So, things like mental illness or developmental delays, things like that?
Yes.
And different ways to kind of treat that, I guess, that's part of the assessment, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the men that we're working with in our facility, and it was Bree's idea when I was trying to, I really liked this guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a very likable guy, crazier than a bed bug.
Yeah.
Just, he really was. And Bree's suggestion, and I couldn't believe the courts bought it, have him go to an inpatient facility in California for 6 weeks, get really stabilized on his medication, and we did. And he went down there, and he really came back. And one of the criteria for him to stay in outpatient treatment, he has to stay on his medication.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets off his medication, he gets... Yeah, he gets crazy. And
when
so
he hears voices and he really is
that's crazy.
So but when he's not, he's okay.
He's okay, yeah.
So yeah, you're absolutely right. We have to make those kinds of decisions. And also in his case, he genuinely had remorse over what he had done. He didn't like himself when he engaged in the sexual behavior with children that he did. He really, and that we have to kind of, you know, there's some guys, oh, who cares? Or they'll, you know, that's a different story. And maybe somebody else can work with that, but I don't know how to do that. Yes, ma'am.
I just want to back up a little bit when you're talking about, at the etchings and
right.
Shame developing on it. And but how about in addiction, the concepts of power or conquest, you know, these trollers? I mean, is there any of that in there other than just fear of intimacy or you know, feeding their shame? I mean, I would think that having power over someone or having one conquest and then another and another, or is it all the same thing?
No, it's not all the same thing, and I'm going to give an answer that is not fair because it's none of those hour-long answers, and I'm going to give it in 30 seconds. Okay. But there are people who are more into what I'm calling sociopathic behavior, and it's not a sexual activity, it's an anger activity, and I want to hurt you, I want to have power over you, I want to rape you, versus a person who is, like most of the incest offenders that we work with, it's all very gentle and very caring, and it's an artificial kind of thing. But what a lot of people wouldn't understand is that the highest success rate on working with child molesters are incest offenders, because none of this is easy, but it's fairly easy as opposed to somebody who's got all those kinds of issues, and I don't work with those folks. But you're right, there are folks that want to hurt other people.
Well, not even in a hurt, but you know, you'd like to, it's like chalk another one up, you know,
sure.
You feel
notches on your belt.
Notches on your belt, sure, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's how about adding 50 more different things as to why.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe not hurtful, but you know, like series of affairs and
certainly. And I'm still going to bring it back to there's something going on that isn't working. And that isn't working stuff really goes back to the very deep parts of me. And when it's not a mental illness where it's a chemical imbalance, but there's just some real hole inside of me that says, I don't know how to develop an intimate relationship in which my intimacy needs are met, but I do know how to go here and in here and in here and in here, and that feels good, and I feel powerful, and absolutely, yes. So let me tell you a couple of things that child molesters say. These are just quotes and so forth. This is an offender's statement. If the church had good child safety policies, people were well informed about offenders and were willing to confront me about my interactions with children, I'd move on to a different church. I mean, they're not stupid. You know, if somebody says, that's not okay here, oh, okay. I mean, so it's not like it's rocket science. It's when everybody puts their head in the sand and says, these are statements from offenders. What families do offenders pick to molest the children? Single-parent families or stressed homes. Single-parent families, not to be pejorative about single-parent, but there's always never quite enough time to take care of, and, you know, if I'll take little Johnny out to the park, boy, wouldn't that feel good? Families that are vulnerable, needy, or gullible. Families where parents and children aren't close and don't communicate. Families that don't supervise their children closely. Families that are not very assertive. And families where one or both parents were victims of child sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. So those are issues that often happen. Here's what some offenders said. How I kept people from calling the police. I said it was an accident, a mistake, or the first time something like this has ever happened. I told them I felt terrible and was going to seek therapy. I told them it would ruin my life forever if they reported me. I told them it was a child's fault. I told them I'd been molested as a child. Just straight. And then let's go back to something else. Remember that in child molest issues, it's nearly all of the time somebody that you know and the child knows. So it's either a family member or someone who has ingratiated themselves into the family. How offenders seduce? Well, no. Offender tricks. And these are, again, from offenders. If a child reacts negatively, back off and try again later. Now, offenders have told me that is only up to a certain point. But there's so many kids that are vulnerable that they won't try too many times. That's why a really assertive child, who you've talked very openly about, and you've said, look, even if your big brother or dad wants to touch you in such and such place, you tell me and you don't, oh, okay. I mean, everybody's really quite open about it. Now, isn't that awful that we have to be? But the truth is, we have to be. Offender tricks, make it feel good. Make the child think they wanted to do it. Confuse children about sex and love and affection. Make it seem normal to act. Make it seem normal. Act like it's a game or it's okay to do. Molest children at night. Reward children for sexual contact. False allegations versus mistakes. Do children lie? Somewhere between 2-4%, and I said yesterday it was 4%, this particular research piece I'm looking at says 2%. Basically, kids don't lie when they say, somebody's touching me, somebody's doing something weird. And as Bree said yesterday, the probably most traumatic thing for a child is not the sexual offense that happened, but it's nobody believing them. Now, it's really tough to believe them if you're, say you're a single mom and you just met this knight in shining armor and he's been in your life for 6 months and your child says he's weird and I don't like the way he looks at me and this, that, and the other, and you're thinking, oh, I don't want to hear that because I really like this guy. You got to listen to that. That's really powerful stuff. Let's see. Interestingly enough, how do offenders keep children from telling? Most don't have to tell children not to tell. It's not a tough sell to get kids to say, this is our little secret. Offender is usually someone the child and the family are close to, like, or depend on. Some children are afraid they won't be believed. Children believe that someone will get in trouble or that the family will break up, and the more incidents, the less likely the child will disclose. The more incidents, because see, they normalize it, and so the more it happens, the less likely that they'll say anything. 16% of offenders are biological parents. 16% of child molest behaviors. 14% are step-parents. 16% are another relative. 26% are an acquaintance or a friend of the parent. And 22% are a youth service worker. So if you go, now you've got the 26 and the 22, you've covered darn near half of it in a good friend of the family or a youth service worker. And then 5% are strangers and 1% fill in some. So, you know, the stranger rate kind of thing, that's just not what it's all about with child molest issues. That you were shaking your head about that.
No,
it's tough.
I have a child.
Yeah. And understand, though, that 95% of people never molest a child. Now, 5% do, but 95% don't. Be open to the possibility that someone you know is a sex offender. Adults, not children, are responsible for the safety of children. Talked a bit about that yesterday, that 10, 15 years ago, the whole thing was, let's equip the children to tell. But what we've really learned is that offenders are too good. And you can't, I'm not saying it's not good to equip the children to be assertive and to tell, but the best thing is to pay attention yourself. At least 95% of allegations are true. When a kid says something, you got to listen. Most victims can overcome the abuse they suffer. Most victims can overcome the abuse they suffer. It's best for everyone if we all report, and the victim family and the offender need to get good treatment. The victim, family, and the offender.
Well, the statistic you said yesterday, I think, is crucial too, that 35% of all women are molested by the time they're 18 years old.
It's sexually assaulted.
That's 1 out of 3.
In America, 35% of all females have not necessarily molested as a kid, but have some sort of sexual assault against them by the time they're 18. So that's a whole lot going on in our society. Tomorrow we'll have another go at it. what can I ask her? What can I answer? What do you want to say?
Well, I guess those are all really scary, scary things, and I don't know if you want to end on that scary note. Because we also have a lot of success in treatment. There's no cure for it, but there are a lot of tools that are available to help people be able to manage their behavior. I don't know if you want to talk about treatment programs or anything, or if you can save that for tomorrow. Or
yes, to both. Societally, we all get terrified, and I say we, I don't know if I can speak for you, I get terrified when I read about people that dismember children and hurt them physically and do all these kinds of horrific things. Two things to remember about that. Of the percentage of people that are sexually assaulting children, meaning not anybody under 18, the smallest percentage are the percentage that do that. The largest percentage are the percentage that are roomy and careful and gentle and loving. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing, but I'm saying that's the largest number. And if the children are believed and we can get that person in treatment, what happens though societally is, at least in Washington State, the laws are continually shifting because people will go down to Olympia and lobby for horrendous, profound, terrible law. I think terrible laws, boy, there's my bias coming out, that puts everybody in the same camp. And there are folks that we can really work with. But when you read in the paper something horrific and you jump to that could happen to my own child, whoa, let's kill them all. And number one, the jails can't hold that many people. And number two, I still think one of the bigger crimes is, what does that do to us inside when we say, I want to take the lepers of this population? Because in biblical times, they took the lepers and they stuck them off over there, because if you hung out with them, you got disease, you didn't want to touch them, so you threw them away and you put them out somewhere else. Well, I'd say child molesters are the lepers of today. Now, I want to be safe. We'll talk more tomorrow about how to be safe, but I also think, what does it do to us inside when we say, well, I'm a Christian, I value Christian values, up to, but not including, child molesters. Mm-hmm. Whew, that does an interesting piece to you inside. It has to. Mm-hmm. So then, and yet I want safety. I don't want my kids, I got grandkids, and I don't want anybody around them, touching them, hurting them in any way. So, it's an interesting kind of problem. But I want to go with what Bree said. We really, given good assessment and high degrees of, we work their fannies off in treatment. I mean, and we take polygraphs all the time, and we have accountability groups. Because we're talking, Bree made up a wonderful strategy, which I think I will end on. If you operate that this stuff is a lot about intimacy and poor social skills and not knowing how to develop that. So they are in treatment with us for 3 to 4 years. And it's a low offense guy, you know, who we think it looks like it's a really good treatment candidate. And I get a lot of ministers, a lot of youth ministers, a lot of guys that get themselves cross that line and get in trouble with a 14-year-old girl. And, you know, that's who. At any rate, one of the strategies that Bree came up with was you have certain exit criteria, like going to college, you know, you got to read this book and you got to listen to this tape and you got to give this report and you got to do it. So then what they have to do in her groups is they have to meet with somebody else in the group by phone, by coffee, whatever, and they go over all that information. Well, guess what? They're now breaking secrets, they're openly talking about it. Then they can bring it into group only after they've talked about it ad nauseum with somebody else. So they're having to do a lot of things over 3-4 years. Another thing that Bree made up, which it's really psychologically sophisticated, and she said, we're going to put you in the playpen because you don't know about boundaries. So when you first come into our treatment facility, you don't get to do much of anything. You can't go to a grocery store where there are children till after 10 o'clock at night when the kids are all off. You can't do this. But eventually you get broader boundaries as you learn those things that you never did learn as a kid, which is what are healthy boundaries.
And what keeps them in the program? Is this like a court mandate? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say 4 years. This is how you're getting your fix. Why would you want to stay? But it's
well, mandated. Because if you mess it up, it's not always this simple, but in Washington...
If they have a volunteer come in or do some volunteers.
We do have some. Yeah, we're going to talk about one tomorrow that's a volunteer. But if you're court-ordered in Washington State and you get a sex offender sentencing alternative, which means you get to go to counseling instead of going to prison, somebody has done one of these evaluations, like myself, and then you're in a treatment program and you get an 8-year sentence, typically, if it's a first-time offense and that kind of thing. It has to be first-time offense, other than that you can't get the SOSA. And there are a whole lot of other criteria that you meet. You get an 8-year sentence. 5 years of it is commuted, and you get 3 years of counseling order. And we do a whole lot of things in that 3 years, and if they don't progress enough, then you go the 4th year, and the 5th year, and the 6th year, and we've never had anybody go this far, and the 7th year, and the 8th year. If you haven't gotten it by then you go to prison and pull your full prison sentence. So they have a... They work really, really hard, and we work them really hard, but lots of it is not just reading books and doing stuff. It's really learning how to be a human being and how to get your internal needs met. At the same time, we're doing polygraphs, and we're talking to corrections officers, and we run a really, really tight program because for a while, they had no boundaries. It's all about boundaries. So we... externally supply the boundaries until they learn to operate with. And we've had really good luck with the chief prosecutor in Seattle has told me that she said, you know, Bill, the people, she said, I never thought I'd say this because they don't like sex offenders, but the people that come out of your program are really nice people when they're finished.
Well, they're highly motivated, extraordinarily motivated to succeed in treatment.
To keep from going to prison, but the people that we have in the program, they don't like what they did. They're disgusted. They're shamed. They don't like that. Oh, it's just...
It's a part of them that's grateful that they were caught, that they have an opportunity to turn their lives around.
That's what I worked with. I was with sex offenders for a while back in the ER, and that was what I heard over and over again, that it was almost a relief when they found out over and over, the relief. So.
And that's not enough.
No, of course.
And I didn't know you didn't say that, but there's a whole lot of stuff. We've got to help them understand these patterns, and we've got to help them understand that when they get lonely, there's some things you got to do about it. And when you get bored, or I'm back to addiction and not where it hasn't gone into deviance, but... There seems to be something in the personality of a guy that works for Microsoft or some of the places that, you know, that work on that screen, and they just get so bored. They just have they want to be stimulated, and they get so bored. Well, man, going into the internet pornography is really stimulating. And so that's a tough one to break to, I mean, we do all kinds of strategies, though. Can you get up and take a walk? Can you make a phone call, which is a human contact? Can you limit yourself? We both know one guy who's done extraordinarily well in the addiction program. He wasn't court ordered. And he allows himself to play video games for 10 minutes. He never had boundaries. So he played video games for 4 hours. But he was a smart guy, so he could get his job done. But you know, now he puts limits on himself. But for the longest time, and when he gets squirrely again, he'll make a phone call before he's going to turn the video game on to another guy in his group. Then he'll make a phone call after he got off and said, I did my 10 minutes. But there's human contact, there's breaking the boredom. But see, that's where it's all at. What were you going to say?
Accountability.
Yeah, accountability. High levels of accountability. And by the way, we really totally support the 12-step programs. There's Sexaholics Anonymous and Sex Addicts Anonymous, but there's not accountability in those programs. So we like them to go to those programs. In fact, we kind of break a rule of the 12-step, which is all volunteer. If you're court ordered to our program, you have to go to a 12-step meeting. Mm-hmm. You don't have any choice. Maybe two or three a week. Because we think the 12-step, but it's not enough because it's not accountable. I mean, there are guys that go to the 12-step meetings and keep reporting the same offense for a year. We got to quit, folks. You were wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.